For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way towards salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. Or in the words of Paul, at present we see indistinctly, as in a mirror, but then face to face. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave.
Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, Mr. Mark Tuttle and Mr. Timothy O'Donnell. And guys, I don't know if you've been watching bestseller lists from the New York Times and the others who tally those numbers, but there seem to be an awful lot of Catholic authors who are popping up on these lists. And I find it kind of interesting in the fact that a lot of these books seem to be selling more copies than what are being reported. And so, you know, there's some skepticism as to the numbers out there. But the one thing I've noticed is the fact that most of these books all kind of have a certain shared theme.
Right. And, you know, whether they're hitting the bestseller list or not, certainly the discussion level around at least three of these books that are out. And you're exactly right, Kent. They're all kind of pointing in the same direction, kind of saying the same thing. So and this one I think is on the bestseller list, Rod Dreher's The Benedict Option, which is a path forward, he says, for kind of a post-Christian world, as he puts it.
That's lots of talk about that.
Lots of talk about that one. Like I said, I think that one actually is on the bestsellers list. The other one that's been out is by Professor Anthony Eselin, Out of the Ashes. And once again, very similar theme of how to renew, classical education to a certain extent.
Yeah, so his is and
much
culture.
And culture. I mean, his is much more, I think, directed towards literature and culture, which stands to reason.
We're going to need.
He's a literature professor. It kind of stands to reason. Right. And then finally, Archbishop Chaput also has a book out. Once again, pointing in the same direction. This one, of course, coming from an archbishop, is directed towards how to renew the church.
Yeah, Strangers in a Strange Land, which is maybe out of the three, my favorite title.
Yes, yeah. But once again, that's kind of directed at the question of how does the church go forward in this post-Christian world that we find ourselves in. So all of these, I think, are stemming off of an insight that's several decades old at this point from a professor that was at Notre Dame at the time, Alistair McIntyre. We've talked about McIntyre on the show before.
Yes.
But his insight was that basically the Enlightenment and the Enlightenment's attempt to base our understanding of the world solely on reason, to kind of get rid of the prejudices of the past, base things on pure reason in one form or another, led to a state where we can't even talk to each other about these things anymore. And we've lost the language of common discourse, particularly about ethics. But even beyond ethics, I think we're seeing, you know, even within science, you throw out a common scientific question. Is the environment, you know, is there actual global warming going on, and is it caused by man? We can't discuss that as a culture. We've lost the ability to have a even scientific discussion about things like that because of the drift of where the Enlightenment has led. And so all three of these books are kind of looking at the aftermath of that and saying, where do we go from here?
Yeah, very, very interesting. I had the opportunity to hear Rod Dreher in person when I attended the symposium, the new evangelization at Benedictine College there in Kansas a month and a half or so ago. And it lays forth a kind of a very interesting plan. And where the controversy comes in, I think, is whether or not, given the advance of the rabid and I would say often destructive advance of secularism, it's really antithetical to Catholicism and other faiths as well. Should we, sort of build monasteries of a sort, and hold up in them, waiting, and wait out the storm, as Saint Benedict of Nursia. I wouldn't say that's exactly what he did, but they were obviously dealing with various kinds of barbarians overrunning Europe, Goths, Visigoths, the Vandals, blah blah blah. Or should we really remain more fully engaged in the public square? Take whatever blows and maybe throw a few punches back ourselves.
Right.
And so these are some of the questions. And these three books come at that same fundamental question that's in front of us in kind of three very helpful complementary ways. So again, Out of the Ashes, Anthony Esselin, Archbishop Chaput, Strangers in a Strange Land, and then The Benedictine Option by Rod Dreher. Those are really, I think, if we're going to create a summer reading list, Mark, I think that would be where we would ask everyone to start.
Right. And, you know, those three, the commonality of all three of them is their calls to rebuild institutions. Central,
yes,
cultural,
yes.
Institution. Rod Dreher's book is directed at rebuilding family and community as a central institution of our society. Anthony Esselin's is rebuilding academia, rebuilding, the intellectual tradition of the West. And Archbishop Chaput's is directed at rebuilding the church, rebuilding the religious foundations of our culture. So they're all based on that idea that culture is really housed by central institutions. And McIntyre kind of threw down the gauntlet and said, look, our institutions have dissolved into chaos because we didn't have a metaphysical basis to base these institutions on. So this show, we're going to need to talk a little bit about how metaphysics gels with institutions, which then leads to ethics, and it leads to academic renewal, and it leads to the rebuilding of our church. But we're going to invite Dr. Peter Redpath of the Adler Aquinas Institute. He's been on the show several times. He's our resident metaphysician here in the cave at this point.
Absolutely.
I think when we have a question of metaphysics, we turn to Dr. Redpath for the answers. But I think the other thing is, we had ended our conversation with him of how to rebuild education. So I think we're going to talk a little bit more specifically about education this show, how we need to rebuild Catholic education as a kind of starter to be able to rebuild our families and communities, as Dreher is calling us to, and how to rebuild the church. And we may follow up in the weeks to come talking about family and community, and then also talking about kind of rebuilding the religious institutions and how to get, really honestly, what we're doing at the Cave is we're trying to peel back the common everyday language that we hear in the press and in books and things like that, and get to kind of the philosophical underpinnings and how the Catholic tradition interfaces with that. So that's a lot on our plate for a show. So we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to invite Dr. Peter Redpath on to discuss metaphysics, education, and how we can build a renewed Catholic educational system.
Catholic Radio, changing hearts and minds.
I started listening to the Catholic radio a few months ago. I guess I'm a little hypocritical right now because I'm not Catholic, and it just makes my day go by so much faster. I love the spiritual family that you have. I just think it's so awesome.
You can help keep Catholic Radio Indy on the air by making a donation at CatholicRadioIndy.org.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Timothy O'Donnell with Mark Tuttle. In the cave, once again, is one of our good friends, a scholar and a Catholic gentleman, Dr. Peter Redpath, who is associated with Holy Apostles Seminary, author of many, many books and articles, especially one I'm reading right now is Volume 2 of the Not-So-Elementary Christian Metaphysics. But also, you have numerous projects going on, Dr. Redpath. We had you in the cave not that long ago, maybe a month or so ago, and we had spent some time talking about and maybe kind of diagnosing sort of the state of affairs in the historical context of higher education. But let me first welcome you back to the cave. I'm eager to get the conversation going, as you can tell. But anyway, welcome, sir.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm most happy to be back with you fellows.
Well, let me start this off, and I'm going to start this off in a kind of odd sort of way, and we'll see what kind of reaction to to this. When I read,
we're kind of used to that from you, Mark.
Yep, exactly. when I read,
usually we say peculiar.
When I read Alistair MacIntyre's After Virtue, which at this point is kind of a classic of reintroducing virtue ethics to try to heal the culture and try to bring back a sense of sort of cultural institutions.
Right.
To summarize kind of the insight that I got, the modern world, modern science has reversed the roles of sociology and ethics to where ethics in modern parlance tends to precede sociology. And what MacIntyre was calling us back to was a world where that's reversed, where sociology precedes ethics. So sociology comes from our sense of who mankind is, which comes from a sense of metaphysics. And so the proper ordering of things would be metaphysics, sociology, and then our ethics proceeds from that. First off, Dr. Redpath, is that kind of a fair assessment of what MacIntyre was getting at in your view?
He was getting at, to some extent, in relationship to language, that the moral discourse is more or less broken down because we've lost the cultural context of it. And in that sense, yes, because the cultural context of ethics really presupposes the classical which got obliterated with the development of philosophy, quote, and the Enlightenment. So yes, you have to return to the metaphysical and moral foundations of Western culture. And Gilson points this out in his Unity of Philosophical Experience. Toward the end, regarding the modern experiment, that the modern world the modern culture is decaying all over the place because we've lost our classical Greek foundations, which are the principles of Western culture, that the highest subject of study for us is human nature, and that human beings are essentially rational animals. Once we forget that, the nature of the human person, especially as Christians, we can't make progress. We regress.
And all of this is sort of an effort to sort of recapture our conversation from the last time we had you on air to sort of set the stage of talking about Catholic education and sort of where we can go from here.
Given the state of disrepair.
Given the state of disrepair, exactly. Where we can go from here to kind of recapture that, to try to get back to what the ancient Greeks were trying to do and try to recapture that within the context of sort of contemporary Catholic education.
The last time I had mentioned the work of C.S. Lewis on the abolition of man, where we'd lost our notion of human beings as rational animals, Lewis agreeing with Gilson, Gilson says that if we lose that sense of a distinctively animal rationality, we turn human beings into beastly men or beastly animals. And Lewis adds to that you can't have a disembodied a soul either. That's not the Christian understanding of a human soul. If you separate the human soul, as was done for centuries after St. Augustine, adopted Platonic thought as a kind of apologetic reinterpret Plato to defend Christianity against attacks, this notion of human beings as incarnate spirits is not adequate for developing a proper understanding of human nature, upon which a proper understanding of human education depends. and human science. This is one of the reasons why I maintain that we can't possibly possess science in the modern world, because you can't be wrong about human nature and be right about science. Our understanding of science is wrong, and if the chief aim of higher education is to generate scientists, then the whole of our higher educational institutions and those who prepare people for education of those institutions can't be rightly ordered.
You know, I had this conversation with my wife not too long ago. We homeschool our kids, and so, you know, the proper purpose of different subject matters, you know, it's a frequent conversation around the dinner table. And we were talking about science and the idea of, you know, modern science being based on, you know, Descartes' dualism and this split, which I think is a lot of what you were just kind of describing, modern man being a split between body and soul and, you know, understanding of the universe being almost two separate worlds. But trying to base science back on Aristotelian metaphysics. And so the question came up, what would a science that's based on Aristotle look like? And so I'll kind of throw that to you. What do you think science done in an Aristotelian sort of way would look like?
Well, it's personalistic. It's based upon a faculty psychology. The chief aim of science is the perfection of the operations of the human person through right habituation of human faculties. If you get rid of human faculties as parts of the human soul, what are you educating? According to St. Thomas, he talks about this in question 77 and 78 of his treatise on man in the Summa. How the human soul has different parts, a higher abstract intellectual part, right, and a participative part, and that we are specifically human beings are not incarnate spirits. We are animals. We're not the dumbest of angels. We're the smartest of animals. And as Gilson once said in his Thomist Realism and the Critique of Knowledge, we sense with our intellects and we intellectualize with our senses. Right? This is very important to understand in relationship to the resurrection of the body as part of the teaching of the Church. Just as each of our sense faculties has what Thomas calls a formal object, an external stimulus, right, that activates it. Like the faculty of sight as color and hearing as sound. Human nature, right, as God, as its formal object, as the fulfillment of our happiness. And that happiness is naturally inclined to be sought in connection with the human body. Human education is education chiefly for the perfection of the complete whole person, and our animal rationality, a kind of abstract rationality that we get through syllogistic reasoning, for example, and a command and control rationality where our reasoning faculty overflows. St. Thomas uses this term. These terms, it overflows into the animal part of the soul, just like the faculty of sight naturally inclines to pursue seeing, the act of seeing. The human soul naturally inclines to pursue contact with an animal body, so that we can secure the intellectual content, the image, the content for our images, and for, you know, our external senses, even before that, so that we can understand how to command and control our emotions, which morally put us in a position to be conducive to learning. If we can't control our emotions, all science presupposes, all higher education presupposes a moral culture. It presupposes the ability to be able to maintain self-control, to engage in self-discipline, to develop a community of inquiry where you're prudential enough to be able to realize that you can perfect human life by cooperating with other human beings who possess talents, who are leaders in one way or another. Once we get rid of the faculty psychology that undergirds a Catholic education, and classical education, we destroy the notion of leadership.
Oh, let me remind our audience that we're talking with Dr. Peter Redpath, the rector of the Adler Aquinas Institute, author of many books and articles. That was a great overview of sort of this Aristotelian understanding of the human and Catholic understanding of the human person, drawing from St. Thomas Aquinas. And it also sounded very, to me, very countercultural to kind of what my experience is in the classroom these days. Because when you talk about, you were mentioning, Dr. Redpath, about, you know, one of the purposes of all this is so that we, you know, our faculties, our reason can control our emotions. I find quite the opposite is encouraged, you know, much to our detriment, around that our emotions are constantly being fanned and inflamed and affirmed. And such that we have to create safe zones now. We have to find, you know, the term snowflakes out there, right? Meaning that, boy, if I hear anything that's, you know, doesn't completely align with, you know, my own feelings, you know, I might melt, or worse yet, I might want you to melt, right? And go on the attack. So how we're in this sort of almost an inversion of what you've described to some extent. What's a way in which we might think about how we move forward in Catholic education? What is sort of like reform? Is it repeal and replace, you know, with Catholic education? What do you think we should, what are some of the steps we might do, or cast a vision of the future of where we might want to go?
Well, the modern Catholic university is based upon the Enlightenment notion of a university based, you know, we divide it into different systems and different departments that become subjects of logical study. It's essentially anarchic and denies the reality of human freedom because it denies the members of the faculty either think of human beings as socialist spirits. Or
great term, yes.
Darwinians.
Yeah. Kind of the not just the smartest animals, but rather the smartest sort of apes, right?
Right, who are completely made of historically.
Right.
Socialist spirits.
Yeah, that's the spirit of the age, right? That's the
modern utopian socialism is the metaphysics, right? And its principles of tolerance. Which are ways of reading history that you have to accept. These are the chief aims of inculcation in modern university education because modern university education functions according to a generic notion of science, which is agreeing with the enlightened intellectuals in whatever they are accepting as true. And what they accept as true is that only mathematical physics puts you in touch with physical reality. So all of science has to be reduced to empirical testing of hypotheses. That's the only legitimate knowledge that we can have of physical reality. So you completely have to obliterate this propagandistic understanding of the nature of science generically and specifically. And the modern university is totally inadequate to do that. It's collapsing under its own sophistry and has to be replaced. We're going back, and Dr. Curtis Hancock and I and some other colleagues from the Western civilization have been working on this since the 1990s to provide we're going back to the time of Alcuin, basically, where what has been needed is a kind of online monastery, which is we created as the Ader Aquinas Institute. Rod Dreher, in his book on the Benedict Option, is trying to discover what we put into place decades ago, and even before us, John Senior, the program for our Great Books Academy and Angelic Academy homeschool programs is a combination of that John Senior's Integrated Humanities program and Mortimer Adler's Great Books program to repersonalize education and focus the attention of education on the perfection of human faculties. This is something that Senior and Adler both recognized and took more or less as evident truth. I often have students come and they ask me when they're interested in pursuing education, and they might have gotten my name somewhere. What should they study at a university in order to become to be able to get a job? And my response is, look, a Catholic education is not chiefly educating you at a university to learn how to develop skills for acquiring employment. It's designed to train you to become an employer, to become a leader. People with no talents cannot be leaders. And if you don't where are your talents located? They're located in habits. Where are these habits located? In neurons? In your brain?
That's an excellent point. I mean, I think one of the things, you know, so because I want us to, I know what's coming up because I'm gonna join you in New York for the Aquinas Leadership Congress in July, and we want to talk about that. I also heard you though say, "What do you run into this?" I got to ask you, Dr. Redpath, because it's a phenomenon. It's an observation that I've had, and I've sort of come to this this sort of understanding about it. What I see in the classroom sometimes, which is that college students are very, very reluctant to discuss any type of like a priori knowledge, anything that fits in that category. So they're okay with, again, kind of that, as you mentioned, sort of this, you know, if it's empirical, if there's data attached to it, then we can talk about that. But if the minute you start talking, the minute you start introducing things that involve things like something that's something or someone that's excellent or the ideal, they dispense with it. They it's almost like they become itchy. Right, they want to just like they like break out in hives, or like they can't even. It's they're mentally, they're just cognitively, they're it's such a struggle. They don't even want to go there because it seems to me that the minute we bring up anything that pertains to say a virtue or an excellence in a human being, it immediately their minds creates an opportunity for a kind of discrimination. Because
right.
There's a kind of distinction that can be made between good, better, best, or good, better, best, or say, you know, mediocre, poor, worse. And they don't want to make any of those kind of evaluations about another human being.
Right. Yes, they're trained in elementary and high school not to be judgmental.
Right, right.
Outside,
even though they're making judgments all the time,
outside of mathematical physics, there they can be judgmental because they've got the principles that put them in touch with reality, supposedly. I had this experience you're talking about while I was teaching on the college campuses, where the biggest problem that I had with students was their skepticism, that they did not trust their own intellectual abilities, and I had to get them out of that that condition. It was so bad, in fact, I remember one case where I had this young lady in class, and I was asking students whether some languages can be better than other languages scientifically considered. From the standpoint of science, and doing scientific work, are some languages better tools for scientific use? And the student said, no, they're all equal. And I said, well, how about a language that
obscure,
that,
right?
it works in hieroglyphs, for example, hieroglyphics.
Right. That's going to make it tough to do advanced physics, I think.
Right. And she said, no, it's just as good. It's just as good as any other.
Right. So it sounds like to me, I was having a similar thing again. Not to go too far afield, but I was having this kind of back and forth, kind of a, I call them Facebook wars, you know, on pro-life issue. And you know, the pro-choice person, you know, was despite evidence, despite arguments and all that kind of stuff, just saw there was, there was no moral distinction in her mind between cancer cells and an unborn baby in the womb. That the subject of an abortion, because they're just both clumps of cells. There was despite no matter how I went at it like three or four different times, and it just kind of dropped off, right? But there was just no moving her off the position that a clump of cells is a clump of cells, whether it's cancerous or whether it's a human, it's a little human being. You know, there's just, and I just think there's something. It was to me, that's another example of how much trouble we're in. Intellectually.
In
this particular case, I asked this young lady whether if a language which had no scientific terms.
Right. You're trying to put her in a corner, right? To try to help her see, right? You're kind of holding up a mirror, right? Say, hey, look, right? But what'd she say?
And by this time, students in the class were getting hysterical. They couldn't believe she's saying this. I said, how could you possibly maintain this? And she said to me, well, you know, if I maintained otherwise, well, like that would be racist.
Right. Yeah, which is that's the damnable sin, right?
Now,
I mean, that's the one
are
you could never do.
With there. This distinction in elementary school, the fact opinion distinction.
Oh yeah. Okay, tell us about that. Yes, our audience needs
that's
to hear.
Where it starts. Okay, and facts are supposed to be only things that you can prove, which you can empirically test. Which evidently that claim can never be empirically tested, right? So all truths then outside of physical science becomes relegated to opinion, and you can't resolve disputes. So
yeah, or feelings. You have feelings. I have feelings.
The only way you can't just develop an apologetic reaction, a dialectical critique of modernity, because that's simply negative. You have to show the inadequacy of trying to identify the perfection of human knowledge, science, in hypothetical guessing, mathematically trained guessing, that intentionally separates itself from the pursuit of wisdom. That's not possible for that to constitute the perfection of the human intellect. It basically reduces science to a kind of sophistry that is located in the human will and just domination of the human will of whatever it is that concerns the human will. You have to return science within Catholic education, especially, to the classical understanding that we are training human faculties. We are perfecting faculties of the human soul. And the methodology of doing that is habituation. We're developing habits within students. by means of which they are getting a more perfect understanding of different kinds of organizational wholes. And the way they're put together. I said that's a more perfect understanding of what science is and the way scientists work, and also the act of induction, where science doesn't start with guessing. Science starts with knowledge. It starts with you getting a more specific understanding that's perfecting a generic understanding with which you start. If you understand nothing in the beginning, you're going to get nothing.
I think that's a crucial point, because when people look at a great books education, or they think of a classical based education, a lot of times where the hard sciences fit into that is hard for people to grasp, you know, and you know, the character building, the habituation, the habit forming. A lot of people look at that and they say, yeah, but we still need to teach science and we need to know science, and that's sort of a separate thing from reading Plato, reading Aristotle, reading Homer, you know, the great books tradition. But you can't separate the two. They have to be integrated into a metaphysical whole that...
Well, we have to start talking about modern mathematical physics as science. It's, at best, a science, sometimes. And most of the people who practice are not engaged in scientific activity. What they're engaged in is a mathematically regulated shrewdness.
Now they would claim that they're engaged in science. So when you say that they're not engaged in science, what exactly are you getting at there?
Well, first of all, they have to define their terms. What do they mean? To me, science is the perfection of human knowledge. And the perfection of human knowledge does not involve applying mathematics and mathematical technologies to guessing, so that you get hypotheses, which are inductions. Science consists chiefly in deduction.
So it's
having sort of a knowledge that is evidently true, from which you make deductions. And the whole purpose of going through empirical testing is to engage in an argument. you're using your sense observation to engage in a conditional syllogism, which you are claiming is the most perfect of all forms of reasoning. You're engaging in an argument. That's where the proof is. Truth doesn't lie in what you sense. Truth is intellectual. It doesn't lie in the will. So what if you can mathematically regulate something and constrain it so that it can be seen or touched? Where is the truth?
Right. To have that sense of truth, you have to have a sense of logic, which is based upon a sense of metaphysics, based on how parts are ordered to a whole.
Well, more importantly than that, logic presupposes induction. This is where you have to have a sensory rationality, the ability to induce the starting points for scientific reasoning presupposes that you can recognize some sort of organizational whole and identify how the parts relate one to another to generate a specific action that interests you. Once you do that, you see, you open up the whole of scientific thinking to all sorts of areas to which it's been denied for centuries. Once you maintain that scientific thinking studies organizations, which is what the ancient Greeks understood it to do, and that human rationality is a sense rationality, and induction starts with sensing the organizational whole with which you're dealing, because you are experientially familiar with it on the basis of your memory, and you start with an evident truth that you know what this is and you're interested in studying it. There's all psychology here. You can't become a scientist unless you are psychologically disposed to become a scientist.
Yep. Well, you have to have
a kind of health, bodily health to do it.
Right.
Well,
you can't be a sociopath.
You know,
like the German. You say, well, you have the German scientists, who who are designing new and more and better ovens with which to create a Holocaust. Huh? Those people aren't scientists.
Right. It's a ghastly example of what you're talking about, right? About how these things are completely detached from the truth. And I can't imagine. I mean, one of the other maybe features of the crisis that we're in higher education too, seems to me, this has been my experience, but you've been in education a lot longer than I have, Dr. Redpath, which is that there's no opportunity for faculty to sort of cross-pollinate or interact with or even discuss across these different disciplines. In other words, the philosopher, the theologian, the ethicist has no contact whatsoever with the biologist, with the medical, the healthcare, you know, professors, and none of that happens, right? And so the biologist, they're really not interested in truth, if it even comes up, in the same way that say the theologian or the philosopher is.
Right, they can't make analogies.
Right. Well, it seems one of the critical purposes.
Sir McIntyre was dead on right. Not only has the language of moral discourse become totally fragmented, the language of scientific and philosophical discourse, what he was applying to ethics, can be applied to the whole of what is quote unquote scientific activity, huh? Where, for example, biologists kill their specimens and tell you they're studying the principles of life.
Right. It's a great example.
Right. Well, Dr. Redpath, I'm going to play a little bit of devil's advocate. We're talking with Dr. Peter Redpath of the Adler Aquinas Institute. We're talking about kind of a pathway towards rebuilding Catholic and classical education. And there's a skeptical argument of trying to base things off of Aristotle and going back to the Greeks. And that is, during the Enlightenment, one of the big critiques was the science they got wrong. They thought there were five elements, fire, air, earth and wind. The mathematics that they had was primitive. Basically the science that Aristotle led to was erroneous and it was primitive. And so modern science now, with the periodic table of elements, with all of the advances we've been able to make, is far superior to what we were able to base on Aristotle. So why would we go back to that?
Well, you're talking about the physics, huh? In Aristotle, where Aristotle those basic elements about which you're talking. The people in modern chemistry started to work with those, and to break them down, to recognize that they were constituted by more primitive elements, but they were still working with attempting to get an induction in relationship to the organizational whole, the operational whole. What is a substance? Huh? And they were maintaining that Aristotle's teaching was inadequate in this area. I did an introduction to a work I edited about 20 years ago by Charles Bonaventure Crowley, entitled "The Aristotelian Thomistic Philosophy of Measure in the International System of Units," SI. Huh?
Available on Amazon. I've seen it there.
Yeah, where Father Crowley indicates that in Aristotle's metaphysics there's an entire philosophy of measure, and that the principles of measure that are used in the whole of modern physics, mathematical physics, are based upon the metaphysical relationship between a one and a many, that unity and multiplicity, are applied to different substances like electricity or to mass and so forth. are the foundation principles for modern physics. And Aristotle gives a better explanation, actually, about this. So Aristotle, this relates to the whole question of induction, and how you initially come in contact with an organizational whole. And Aristotle, like Galileo, points out with respect to the heavens, he didn't have telescopes and so forth, so he could not get to the initial induction, right? But his principles about the nature of induction, right, and how they operate, were better than the modern versions of it. For example, a person who's a sculptor gets the principles of induction, right, about how to work with a specific material by actually applying different kinds of technology, you know, like hammers and so forth, the material to touch things. As Anton Pegas was fond of saying that a pianist, for a pianist, the intellect is in the fingers. Right? So the starting point for all scientific activity, as Aristotle recognized, now Aristotle's principle in induction is superior, right, to the modern understanding of the nature of induction. And if you're wrong about induction, you're going to be wrong about everything that you derive from it. And it's not the case that in every case related to induction, you have to be working with a material and operating with it on it with this particular technology or that particular technology. People who are engaged in moral activity are engaged in inductions regarding doing good and avoiding evil, and based upon experience, for example, experiential knowledge of making choices that are healthy or not healthy, that this is the right thing to do, for example, in the individual situation. So my critique of modernity is basically it doesn't understand the nature of induction. And because it doesn't understand induction, it can't, and because it mistakes the genus of the scientist with the genus of the logician, that it conflates logic and the subject of science, and tends to reduce the whole of science to one kind of mathematical logic
used to torture nature to reveal its secrets.
Right.
Yeah. That's your quote. I'm quoting you because I love that phrase. I think that's so true. Hey, before we run out of time, Dr. Redpath, can we get a little bit of information for our audience about the upcoming Aquinas Leadership World Congress in New York?
That's the Immaculate Conception Seminary in Huntington, Long Island, from the July 13th to July 16th, Thursday, July 13th, and it basically ends on the 15th with the 16th people just staying over and having breakfast and then leaving. So Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. We have a good group of people already coming, about 25 people.
I just sent in my registration form, and I sent you my abstract, so here I come, ready or not.
Yes, we have you lined up to do an interview.
Yeah, we're going to bring the cave on the road. Right. Yes, that's going to be fantastic, yes.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to it. People are excited about it.
What's sort of the prominent feature or theme of the World Congress?
It's Augustine Aquinas and the apologetics of the New Reformation.
Fantastic. That's why I'm going to do something on Girard because it doesn't fit at all.
Hey, Girard, yeah. And what's happening in Catholic education is problematic still because people don't understand that apologetics, in the sense of dialectical logic, just to defend your teachings, is not enough. It's not good enough in order to be able to defend Christian teachings, because actually Christianity has a much richer intellectual tradition than modernity. And unless we right now we're existing in a situation where the Enlightenment's dying. The Enlightenment institutions are dying. And colleagues of mine and I have seen this for decades, that this was going on, and they had to be replaced. They had to put into place other institutions, and we've been developing them for several decades. And this World Congress is related to involving people in this international kind of online monastic preservation of the best elements of Western culture, to strengthen and foster them as much as we can.
Well, I'm super excited to be a part of it. I can't wait to come out and meet everyone and learn and help contribute to the mission of the Institute. So thank you for coordinating that and leading that and putting that on. I know you've got lots of other books and stuff in the works. What I'd like to do is invite you back real soon so that we can talk about some of your upcoming projects. So if our listeners want to get a hold of you, Dr. Redpath, what's the best way to do that? They want to follow some of your work.
To check out my my webpage at the Aquinas School of Leadership online, and my ethics text, the moral psychology of St. Thomas Aquinas, has just come into print.
Oh, it has?
Yeah.
All right. Is it available like on Amazon?
Well, it's available from on Amazon, but also on. The En Route Books and Media.
Oh, fantastic.
With, you know, people might be able to get a better price on it from En Route.
Sounds great. Well, again, thank you so much, Dr. Redpath. It's been a great pleasure having you back in the Catholic Cave.
Well, thanks once again. I always enjoy talking with you folks.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave, where we just got done with a fantastic conversation with Dr. Peter Redpath of the Adler Aquinas Institute, Holy Cross Seminary. Fantastic discussion of Catholic education, kind of where we need to take things and how we need to go back to the Greeks, go back to Aristotle's understanding of education as a formation of the human person. And that means getting back to a proper understanding of the human person composed of, you know, faculties, and then how, you know, that perfection leads into an exploration of science, not for the sake of mathematical measurement, but for the sake of actual knowledge and inductive understanding. Fantastic conversation.
It was. There's so much more we can look forward to speaking with him about in that area. I really appreciated the conversation and his insights around what I think are one of the classical points of tension, which is the purpose of education. Is education for integral human development and flourishing, right, building up the person? Or is education, especially higher education, simply kind of like, you know, job skill training in ideally in a highly specialized field that results in, you know, a highly compensated career field. We're out of time. That's it for the Catholic Cave. There's a lot more to be said next time.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of The Catholic Cave. If you have a question or comment regarding this program, please address an email to Kent, K-E-N-T, at CatholicRadioIndy.org or call 317-870-8400. Replays of this program are available on podcast at CatholicRadioIndy.org. Just click on the programming tab, then go to podcasts of local programs.